basic arguments that are used, making sure my recorder is on here, the five basic arguments that are used to demonstrate the existence of God. And these are arguments that theologians have used for people who don't believe that the Bible is God's revelation. They don't believe any of the things that we take for granted as Christians. They're supposed to help explain God's existence on the basis of reasonable reasonable investigation alone. We know as Christians, I hope, that you can come to a rational understanding that God exists without actually believing in Him. Just like you can come to a place where you believe the truths that are in the Bible, and know that they're valid and true without actually being a Christian, right? Who does that very well? Satan does that, right? Satan knows the Bible better than any of us. He's a wonderful theologian. He's an expert at biblical knowledge, and yet he's not a believer in Jesus. So, we left off with the moral argument. We talked about the cosmological argument, the ontological argument, and the teleological argument. Who can just give this little brief summary of these people who were not here last week? Okay.
Just sort of the natural state of things.
The cosmological natural state of things, a little more specific.
Nothing comes from nothing.
That's excellent. Yes. Nothing comes from nothing. All right, so we all agree with that premise, right? Nothing comes from nothing. So the cosmological argument suggests that if the cosmos is made up of contingent or dependent things, right? I'm dependent on oxygen, air, my mommy and daddy who conceived me, and food, water, all that kind of stuff. I'm a dependent being. If the whole cosmos is made up of dependent beings or things, then we've got to ask the question, where did all this stuff come from in the beginning? How did it get here? It can't be the cause of its own existence because nothing can be before it is, right? That's got it. Okay, that's right. Cosmological argument, huh?
Right.
Everyone's following?
Yeah.
Good. I want to go over, we're just kind of summarizing what we did last week, so if it seems like we're going fast, don't worry, we're going to slow down when we get to the moral argument, which is after the teleological, because I just want to refresh everyone's memory. Who can give me a brief summary of the ontological argument?
St. Anselm.
Oh, well, yes, I sent that out by email. If you had a chance to read the read that, St. Anselm is the author of the ontological argument. Hey, Joyce, you made it.
Oh, I've been here.
Oh, okay.
I never left.
I saw your car. I thought maybe you took a nap or something.
No, I was talking to my daughter on the phone.
Hmm. No, it's great to see you. All right. So what did St. Anselm say? What was his?
He said what you wrote down, but I can't paraphrase it by saying just because.
Just because, right?
You have an idea of God in your head. It's proof that there must be a God, because if you have that.
He was trying to find an intuitive proof for God. Now, what's the difference between intuitive and apprehensive reason? We talked about this in the very first class.
What you know by experience, or
you just know,
right? Yeah.
And then apprehensive is something you got to think through, right? So, trigonometry is apprehensive. That's not something we just naturally. Oh well, I know the tangent of something. We just don't do that. The fact that this chair will hold me if I sit on it, that's intuitive. I just know that without having to. St. Anselm said that is actually that God's existence is part of our intuitive reason, not our apprehensive reason. We don't have to reason to Him. And his argument for that was that when someone says there's no such thing as God, they have an idea in their head, don't they?
Right.
What is this idea that they have? For God. What is their idea of God? What is it? Who do they know that this God is that doesn't exist? What's their idea of this God?
Something greater than anything else.
Right.
Something
beyond which or greater than which anything, nothing else you can see that's greater than this God they have in their mind. Right? And so Anselm's point was, well, we have these three spheres of things. We have things that... I'm sorry. Drew an extra circle here. We have things that don't exist, but we can conceive of, right?
Unicorn.
That's good. What's another thing you can conceive of that doesn't exist?
Leprechaun,
right? And then we have things on this, in this other circle, things that...
Husband to an argument.
I'm sorry?
Husband to an argument.
He's well trained.
Right. Things that could exist, but we just don't know, right? Other stars. I mean, we can conceive of them; they may exist. We just don't know. And then things that both we can conceive of and that do exist, right? So Anselm's saying, well, look, if the idea of God is something than which nothing greater can be conceived, then the very thought would necessarily imply that it can't just exist in the unicorn category. It has to exist also in the existent category. Now, how many of you guys found that argument persuasive?
Yeah.
You didn't? Oh, okay. I never found that argument. I always thought the argument was a bunch of... Because really, it's just to me, it always seemed like an assertion, but I'm not... If you find it persuasive, that's good. Really, what Anselm was doing was he wasn't really trying to persuade non-believers. He was trying to firm up the belief of those who already believe. So,
they all seem to overlap.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Some
they do. What prompted that comment? Why in particular? Did you see something?
Well, I'm jumping the gun to teleological.
Yeah. Okay, let's do that because we're kind of reviewing. I don't want to get... stuff reviewing for the entire class as you jump to teleological. What was the teleological argument?
What comes to mind when you speak of teleological, and I don't know if I grasp it correctly, is something along the lines of irreducible complexity.
That's one argument for design in the cosmos.
Design.
Right.
Creation.
Argument from design. What is irreducible complexity?
Yeah,
too complex for me.
I'll take a minute. I was thinking of Vicky's been visiting me from time to time, and she knows of the little bugs I have on my house. They're called boxcar beetles.
Those are cool.
Huh?
They're cool.
But they're small.
I know.
And there's, you know, we could take either these little tiny bugs, or we could take the human's body, and so you get reduced down to where you just can't reduce it any further, such as a cell, or a mitochondria, or
a nucleus,
whatever, the nucleus.
Nuclei, yeah.
And whichever one of the other two theories we were talking about, infinity, you speculate that in infinity, someday we're going to win the lottery if we play the same numbers over and over and over. But even in infinity, backwards or forward, you're not going to have the human cell just accidentally happen.
Mm.
It's got to have a designer. It's got to have a creator.
Mm. And the reason is that random things that are
random
have don't have order and intelligibility, right? Right, so again, this is the example we were using the other day. I just know if you walk into a room, you saw that, you would not think that I purposely came through and went to put them in the... But if you came in and you saw this in a very neat, not very neat, but okay, relatively neat drawings, you'd say, hey, someone must have done that. And that's basically the argument from design. They look at creation and they say, look at the order there in the cosmos. And we know from experience that when random events take place or when things occur randomly, we don't get that kind of order. You put a million monkeys in a room with a typewriter and they're not going to produce
Shakespeare.
What's that?
That was a good book, those monkeys wrote.
Right. In fact, they did an experiment about 10 years ago where they put a number of monkeys in a room with a typewriter.
That's what I was talking
and they were trying to get a line, one line from Shakespeare's the thing was really low. The monkeys just had to get all the words necessary on one sheet of paper to make the line from one of Shakespeare's plays. And they thought, well, if they estimate how much time it would take these monkeys to do it, I forgot how long they left the monkeys in the room, but they didn't do it. They couldn't even get the right letters in sequence. So given the time that we know there have been living beings on Earth, and the way that we know order and random or random chance works, it's very unlikely that we would see the order that we have in creation or in the cosmos unless there was something or someone out there ordering and imposing. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Irreducible complexity is a little bit different. That's an interesting idea. This is the idea that, let's say, have you ever heard of the bombardier beetle?
Related to unboxing.
It's a little bit. But the bombardier beetle has this kind of mechanism whereby if a predator comes and tries to eat it, it has these two tubes in the back of it.
Is it a stinky thing?
It's not stinky.
Oh, okay.
It's actually like a flamethrower.
Oh, cool.
it's why it's called bombardier. If it's attacked by a predator, it can shoot out this fire, basically. If you go Google it, I'm
going to
see it. And so the question that people who believe in intelligent design, for example, as opposed to evolution, will ask is, all right, well, here you have this system where chemicals mix and cause an explosion, right? So you've got to be very, both parts of that system have to be very well developed before any part of it can be put into an animal. I mean, so what part of that evolved first? I mean, did you have like the, I mean, you at some point, you've got to say this bombardier beetle had to have just sprung up into existence, or there's really no other explanation for slowly evolving a system that interconnected, and with that many component parts that are interdependent. That's a total.
Couldn't have happened by accident.
Yeah, couldn't have. It's very. I mean, it couldn't have happened by accident if it. Right.
But really, doesn't that take more faith than believing the Bible? I mean,
what the?
To believe that it all was an accident.
I mean, oh, it does. I mean, in fact,
I mean, if you think about it, I mean, it takes more faith. I mean, at least if you believe in the Bible, God's in the beginning of the first chapter. So.
Right.
I mean, He creates everything. But if you don't have that, I mean, what do you believe? I mean,
We were talking in Christian Ed on Sunday morning about when you get someone to the point where they're stumped. An atheist evolutionist, for example, and they can't explain the origin of life. It's because there's not enough time for the chance mechanism to work in the way they say it does.
Right.
In the known length of time that we have in our earthly world. So how do they explain the emergence of life? Richard Dawkins says, well, it must have come from outer space. I mean, really, you're at that point, you're leaping.
Wait a minute.
Well, his thought is it's probably a meteor or
not aliens.
Not aliens necessarily.
Okay.
But it sounds, I think he'd be more likely to believe aliens brought it than the guy.
A former friend of ours that we went to church with, and she's a recent atheist, unfortunately. And she's tried several different religions. The last one she tried was the JWs. And she's not finding what she needs in any of them, sadly. And so she said that she's now an atheist, and I did talk to her, but she said one of the most difficult things that she's having acceptance with is the fact that there's nothing out there, and that she's going to be nothing when she dies.
Right.
And she says she has nightmares over this, and I'm just like, oh, you poor woman. You know, I mean, it's just like, ugh.
But put yourself back, if you can, to the time when Darwin first came out with his Origin of the Species.
Yeah.
And for the first time, people had a way to explain life on Earth apart from God. They could say, they believed they had a theory that allowed for a godless cosmos. Now for them, or many of them anyway, that was totally freeing. There's no more judgmental, wrathful God looking over our shoulders. We come into existence and then we just die. Right? So there's nothing to really govern our behavior beyond our own reason and will. And so at the time, it wasn't seen as a despairing principle, but as a freeing principle. Now, I mean, after 200 years of living with it, we see the results. But at the time, it was a liberating.
Especially like when we went to Norma's funeral this morning, I said to him, it's so nice to have somebody pass on surrounded by their friends and family, knowing that they're going home, and that they'll be with them one day. And, you know, it was beautiful. And it's so nice to have that as opposed to, oh, well, so-and-so's getting eaten by the worms. And, you know, they're all
right, you don't know where they are.
Out,
right.
You know, who knows where they are. And I was like, yeah, no, thank you.
we don't mourn like people who have no hope. All right, let's move on now to the moral argument for God's existence. This is made popular recently by C.S. Lewis, right? I think I asked before, how many of you had read Mere Christianity? Okay, right. Now, how does Mere Christianity start out? What's the first page?
It starts off talking about an argument.
Yes, there's an argument. Two people are having an argument. What are they arguing about?
I forgot exactly, but it was a moral principle. Somebody was right, somebody was wrong.
Crowded in line or something?
They
were crowding in line or...
Yeah, it was a dispute about who had the right to be someplace in line.
I've started it five times, but...
Well, the moral argument does start off, C.S. Lewis's Mere Christianity does start off with this moral argument. He gives the example of two people arguing about who has the right to be at a certain place in line. And he says, well, now, this argument's interesting. And you hear both Christians and non-Christians, people who believe in God, people who don't believe in God, engaging in arguments of this sort. But what do both people in that argument have to believe in order to even have the argument?
They're right.
That there's a right.
That there is, that there's a certain absolute measure out there. That they're both disagreeing about how it applies in their particular situation, but they both agree that it's there. Like both of them agree, for example, that the person who is there first should be in should be there in the line, but they might disagree about who got there first. So there's this moral law that is beyond both parties in a dispute. I mean, it's not intrinsic to them. So it's external. And as they said, absolute. What does absolute mean in this context?
Indisputable.
It's right. Indisputable.
Free of error.
It's the measure of things, right? Like, so the difference between absolute and relative.
Universally binding?
There we go. Universally binding. I like that better because
show off.
That's not good.
The opposite of absolute would be relative. So, if I say 1 + 1 = 2, that's not something that is just not my opinion, right? That's just not relative to me. That's
right.
Absolute truth. If I say chocolate ice cream is the best, that's relative. That's my opinion, but you may not share it. Although you'd be wrong.
sorry, I can't come to your
church
anymore.
Right. So we have this external moral absolute standards that everyone agrees exist, and then the question becomes, where does this standard come from? Why do we have this? Where is it evolutionarily necessary? Atheists would say, well, this is easy to explain because you just go back and you think about Nietzsche called the herd mentality, right? All morality stems from our primordial past, where for some reason it became recognized as helpful to the community not to steal, as opposed to being helpful. It became helpful to the community not to murder rather than not helpful. And so all of our morals kind of evolved over the course of our social interactions. Well, people who argue for an existence of an absolute morality might say, well, there are some things that just don't make sense when you look at herd morality. What does a herd do with the weak?
Kick it off.
And that's not, you know, but I think just generally, I mean, that's not necessarily something that all human beings do, even in places where they haven't had the benefit of Western education. people tend to care for their sick, their age, and their young, in a way that not all animal groups do. Where did that come from? Why do we do that?
I know, I get this magazine, Archaeology, which is, you know, very basic stuff, but they're constantly finding new things about the fact that ancient people actually took care of their dead very carefully.
Yeah.
You know, or took care of their sick very carefully.
Yeah. Right. And it's interesting, every culture, you're right, the burial rites go all way, way back. And it's interesting, too, when you think of the way justice is done in various cultures. Every culture has a way for, or process by which, when a crime is committed or something is done that's wrong, there's an attempt to get at the truth of the matter. The facts are in dispute. Now, we have our own, we have a justice system with police, we have investigations, but even in more, our less developed societies, you have, you still have an attempt to find out what's the true fact of the matter here, who did the wrong. So and that's how the society functions, is to have these have these people recognized by the community who are adjudicating between right and wrong.
Side A, side B, and then the truth.
Right, right. Let's figure the truth of the matter, and once you find the truth of the matter, again. So all of this points to the existence of someone or something beyond us. The good that everyone sees and everyone recognizes. And it can't, if it can't be explained by natural development, then it must... those who argue for the moral argument say that it must at least point to a being that is the author of the law. Someone beyond the cause, someone beyond our own plane who has given us this, or who has created this sense of right and wrong.
C.S. Lewis wasn't.
For a while, yes. He was, well... Yeah, for a while he was an atheist, that's true. And then he was agnostic, and then he became a Christian. Does this make sense, this argument?
Yeah, it does. Because every culture has rules, and, you know, I mean, if you do certain things in some cultures, you'll get in trouble. I mean, there's rules, there's regulations, there's things you can't do, there's taboos. And how they deal with them may be different, but it's all the same thing.
It's all an attempt to get to the same thing, which is this, and everyone.
To the good.
right.
Right.
So, all right, let's, if everyone understands the moral argument? Okay.
Sure.
Good.
Inside out.
Inside out. I know this is very brief. I mean, I'm not going to give you, I could go into more detail, but I don't want to do that because systematic theology is such a broad subject, and if we spend as much time we could on every topic, you'd be going home and never coming back. right. The last argument is the argument from congruity. This is basically a conglomeration of some of the reasoning that's gone into all of the arguments before him. What does the word congruity mean? I'm sorry, I'm not writing very clearly. Let me write that a little bit more.
Equal to something else.
Huh?
Congruent is when something's equal to something else.
Yeah, basically.
The whole of the parts.
Yeah, correct.
Congruent. Congruent, I'm sorry. Congruity. Some theologians want to back up and take all of the arguments together, the moral argument, the teleological argument, the ontological argument, and the cosmological argument, and say, look, based on the data that we have in creation, in the cosmos, the most reasonable answer for how all this stuff came to be, you know, this reasonable answer, all the questions each of the arguments raises, is God. Any other answer takes a lot more faith than the answer that God is and that God created. Very simple argument. This is basically a summary of all the others. Conclusion, right. Argument from congruity. So if you've mastered all the other arguments and you're talking with someone who's an atheist, then you've raised all these questions in their head and you can kind of end with this argument from congruity. Look, we've raised this question about how the cosmos came to be. We've raised this question about your understanding of who God is in your mind. We've raised this question about the design that you see and you've acknowledged in the cosmos. We've raised a question about the moral rights and wrongs that you and I know exist. So let me ask you, what other explanation do you have that's more reasonable than God for this? We can't, you can't argue for evolution on, you can't argue that these things evolved, you can't argue that they came from nothing. The most reasonable explanation is God.
And what is their answer to
that?
There are still
people who disagree, right?
People who disagree, given those arguments. Having heard the argument on congruity, still arguably intelligent people who are atheists.
Does everyone have a Bible with them? Turn to Romans 1. There you go. It happens. I'm telling you that. I mean, that you'll get to a point with some people where even when you feel like you've had a good discussion and you've got been able to get your point across in a relatively sufficient way, some people are just they will not believe, and I think that's what Paul is talking about there. And we've read this passage before. In verse 1, or chapter 1, verse 18, the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all the ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who, by their unrighteousness, suppress the truth. There is this desire on the part of every human being to suppress the truths that we're bringing to the fore with these arguments. That's what these arguments are for, is to try to make it more difficult for them to suppress the truth of God's existence, that they know. That's what Paul says here, that for what can be known about God is plain to them. They know it, because God has shown it to them, for his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world.
Paul's almost making an argument for one of the arguments.
Yep. He's, all of them can be found there, the ontological argument, the cosmological argument, teleological argument, most. And then in chapter 2, the moral argument can be found there in Romans 1. It's an amazing bit of work there that's inspired by God. But you're always gonna run into people who, despite your best efforts, are just not going to believe.
Can you summarize again the argument for congruity?
The argument for congruity is really an end point. It's after you've reasoned with someone through all of the various arguments, the argument from the cosmological argument, the ontological argument, teleological argument, the moral argument, you've, in that process, you've raised a number of questions. The question of origin of life, for example, in the teleological argument. The question of how dependent beings can exist in the cosmological argument. You've raised the question of how we have a sense of right and wrong in the moral argument. And you've raised the question in the person's own mind about, well, where do you get this idea of God from? You know, it's kind of, and Anselm's argument. And you raise all these questions, and your the congruity argument is just basically like a question. You're saying, well, the most reasonable answer to all of these questions that I've raised, the one that answers all of them, is that God exists. There's no other system of thought, there's no other philosophy that provides an answer to all these questions. Sufficiently, anyway.
And is that the issue of all these arguments? Is that the issue?
No, it's not the issue. I mean, Paul tells us what the issue is. It's the heart issue. I mean, it's not a mind issue. It's a heart issue. What we're doing with these arguments is not trying to, say, persuade someone to becoming a Christian. We can't do that. What we can do, though, is we can weaken their suppression power, right? So that they're having to really put forth the effort to suppress the truth of God, and then pray the Holy Spirit will break them down, right, and bring them to the point of faith. Soften their heart, right. I say break down. It's soften the heart. It's much better, much nicer way of putting that. right. Okay. Now from these arguments, now we're moving over into a different section. We're moving into talk about the attributes of God. The arguments for God's existence might seem like a detour, but it's really not. Because each of those arguments point to different aspects of God's character and nature. We spoke a little bit about what has to be true about God if he is going to be the being who creates all other beings. He can't be a dependent being, right? Because why couldn't he be a dependent being or a contingent being?
Because something else would be responsible for his existence.
He couldn't be God, right?
Everyone else, right?
Right.
Who made God was the question we often ask.
Exactly. So there can be no... There can be really no limitation to God in any way. Why would I say that? Why can there be no limitation to me? Let's say God is greater than any of us, all of us, right?
Yeah.
He's been more powerful than anything that we can conceive of. Okay, but does that mean that all of his qualities are in the superlative? Are they so great that they cannot, objectively speaking, absolutely speaking, be any greater? Are they the perfection of all things? Well, how can we be sure of that? How do we know that he's not limited in some way? Well, because he's God. The cosmological argument actually answers this question, because if there is a limit in God. Let's say this is a big ruler, and God is better than all of us, but he's only, but he's still, we're way down here, and it's like a measure of maybe knowledge, okay? And human beings have about this much knowledge. God has, like, all this knowledge, but, there's still some things maybe that God doesn't know, which some people say, some theologians say that. Clark Pinnock says that. So what if we make this assertion? What then becomes greater than God at this point?
Knowledge.
Whatever this measure is,
yeah.
Right? Whatever this measure is greater than God, and that means that God is no longer. There's something above and beyond God that has. It stands over him as a judge, something. If we apply this to all his attributes, then some person. So we have to keep going and going and going. So to avoid that problem, the cosmological argument makes it necessary that the necessary being, the first being of all creation, was superlative or perfect in all of his attributes. Everything that we know about God is, every aspect of God, or every character trait of God, everything that pertains to God's character, pertains to him in perfection. There's no limit to it. There's no limitedness to it.
Have any schools of thought given a name to that more superlative entity?
God. I mean, that's the thing. There is no, if whatever, if there is a more superlative entity, then that's God. I mean, that's the problem. Is you to posit a limitation in God, you're also positing there's a measure out there somewhere that's beyond him. And then you've posited really another God, which you've done, is what you've done.
Yeah, a lot of people try to prove it's Satan, but obviously it's not. But a lot of people try to prove that Satan's superior to God.
Does that make sense? Maybe I'm not making, I'm not being clear.
That,
okay.
There's some arguments on not necessarily the Christianity of the idea that God is all powerful, but there's also a kind of balance of God that is just as powerful but evil. So there's a contention between the good and the evil, and then so really there's no control at the end of the day if you think of that. There's even whatever you think God is doesn't have control because it's still balancing and fighting. And
that's right.
Life is still up.
It's interesting when you hear what's one ancient faith that that believes this kind of fight between the two powers of good and the powers of evil. Zoroastrianism, right? Zoroastrianism believes in this kind of ancient battle between good and bad. Well, what's the problem there? I mean, how do you define good and how do you define bad? And where does this measure come from of good and bad? And whoever that measure is, that's really God. I mean, so these kind of dualistic systems defeat themselves. All right. Let's define what we mean when we talk about the attributes of God. I'm gonna just make two distinctions here. Communicable, C-O-M-M-U-N-I-C-A-B-L-E, attributes, and incommunicable, I-N-C-O-M-M-U-N-I, that's horrible spelling, I've used the board kind of like just to so I can think, I'm not always writing as I should, frankly.
A good disease.
a good infection. That's actually a title for one of the chapters of Christianity. The attributes of God are his, we can call them traits, his
characteristics.
And these are gleaned both by reason, like we talked about from the various arguments, and from Scripture. The two forms of revelation reveal to us the various attributes of God's character. Now, some of them are communicable attributes, and some of them are incommunicable attributes. When you mentioned communicable diseases, what do you mean by a communicable disease?
Something that can be passed on to other people.
Right. Okay. And if it's an incommunicable disease, like what is it that can't really be passed on?
Diabetes?
That's not catchy. No. You don't get it if you have someone who you're hanging out with who's diabetic. The attributes of God can be distinguished in the same way. Some of them are communicable, meaning that he has passed them on to his creatures, us. And others, we just have no real way of grasping his nature in those respects. Can someone just off the top of their head think of maybe an example of a communicable attribute?
Kindness.
Love, kindness. Yeah, both. Really good. Let's take love. Use that as our example of communicable. Can you give me an incommunicable attribute, maybe?
We can have that attribute also.
Yeah, we can have love, right? That's communicable.
So that's what you define by communicable, is the attributes of God that has passed on to us.
That we also share.
And we also share in those attributes, not like knowledge-wise, just actually share it in those attributes.
We share. They're also part of our character.
Right. Okay.
Not in a superlative way, right? God is the measure and the origin and the definition of love. We sometimes love, right? We can love, but we're not love. God is love.
Is perfection an incommunicable one?
Huh?
Perfection, God's perfection.
I don't know if I would call that an attribute so much as it's a description of all his attributes taken together, but.
It's more like a state of being.
Omniscience?
There we go. What is omniscience?
All knowing.
I'm sorry?
All knowing.
All knowing, right. We can know, but we can't be. Our knowledge doesn't have the same kind of breadth and depth, and we don't have the type of knowledge that God has. Another example, maybe make it more graspable, is omnipresence. What does omnipresence mean? God is everywhere. I can't tell you how many times a pastor, someone comes to me and they say, well, I don't want to pray because I don't want to bother God with my problem. So I pray, I don't want to always whine to God about me and me. And that, well, you know what? If God is omnipresent, which scripture and reason should tell us that he is, then every moment that you spend with him, or God can focus his entire attention on you. He does focus his entire attention on you for your entire life, every single moment. And when he does that, he's not taking attention away from anybody else. It's not like he's saying, okay, well, Mildred, you wait for a minute. I've got to go listen to so-and-so. He's everywhere.
It's like that Bruce Almighty.
Yeah. I've never seen it.
God gave him all his power, so people start praying to him, and he started going crazy because... You know, there's all these people praying to him, and he couldn't deal with it.
He made a list on his computer with his name and their prayers. He was getting all confused.
So he answered everybody. Just, yes.
Yes.
Yes. Really everybody. Yeah.
That's great. We say God is everywhere, in every place, every time. So God is both at the garden right now, and God's now. He is in the Garden of Eden with Adam and Eve. And he's here, and he's at the cross, and he's at the very last day. He's there, right now. God's not waiting for these things to take place. God is in all those things there at that moment, and he sees all those things at the moment at that time. That's what omnipresence and omniscience together mean. Now, we don't get that. We're a localized person. We have, we're here now. I can't also be at home. I wish I could.
Right.
If I could be too... If I had a twin, I got things I could get done. But I'm only one person. I can only be in one place at one time, and so are you. So this is an incommunicable attribute. We don't have that. We can get a sense of it. We can get a sense of omniscience because we have memories of our past, and we can have an idea of what's going to happen in the future, and we exist in the now. But that's just an idea of it. We don't know it in the way that God knows it. We don't see it in the way that God sees it. So everyone understand this difference between the communicable and the incommunicable attributes of God?
What would sacredness be?
Sacredness? Holiness?
Yeah.
That's one of the communicable attributes. Okay. Now, are we totally holy? No, but are we being made holy? Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's something that God communicates to us.
Right, because I don't like you can sanctify people.
Some cultures all around the world have an idea of something's being sacred.
Yeah.
That's right. Now, I'm going to write down a list of the incommunicable attributes of God. These are the incommunicable attributes of God, and we're going to talk about each one of them. And you'll have them in your notes. Aseity. We'll define them as A-S-E-I-T-Y. Immutability. Impassibility. Eternal. eternity. Omnipresence. Omniscience. Omnipotence. And we'll stop there for right now. We have 10 minutes left. We won't get anywhere near that. Let's. Does everyone have that list down? You'll see it again. I'm just going to write it up so you get an idea of where we're.
Can you define
the CFD? Yeah, I'm just going to write the list. I'm going to go down one by one, so I'll define each of them. I just went there.
What's the one?
Aseity. Aseity. It's a very. I love the word. It's one of my favorite words.
Like
it makes you sound really smart if you say it too, so you should use it. Try to use it into a sentence.
What? Audie just asked.
What's that? Is that a sentence? No. Aseity is a. I'm going to erase. If you've got these all down, I'm going to erase these. They'll be in your notes there, so you'll. And I'll go down one by one through them. Aseity is essentially independence. We talked about this, or self-existence.
Does it come from Latin?
I don't know if it comes from Latin or not. I bet it does.
Yeah,
I'm not sure.
SCIs.
Independence of self-existence. And we've said this flows right out of the cosmological argument we've talked about. God doesn't have a need for any other being to bring him into existence. He doesn't depend on another being to continue in existence, and he doesn't have. This is another thing you often hear when you ask the question of Christians, well, why did God create? And Christians will sometimes say, well, because he wanted someone to love. He was lonely. No. I mean, yes, he created out of love. I mean, it's because he loved that he created, that's true. But, I mean, God wasn't like, oh, man, I really wish I had someone to talk to. he doesn't, that's not why he created. He had plenty of people to talk to. He had the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit, his Trinity, existing forever in himself. So all this says that there's no power, no thing, no being out there that caused or sustains or in any way determines God's existence. He is independent. Now, it also has to do with his will in some ways, too. His will is not bound by anyone or anything. He's an utterly free being. He can he does as he pleases. Now, Muslims also have this concept of God. I want to distinguish our understanding of God's freedom from theirs because it helps us to understand why the God that we worship is not Allah. At least as they understand. For a Muslim, whatever God does is right. So God can give a law, and name a law, right? And then God can break that law, and it's good. For Christians, the law is not independent of God. God has given the law as a reflection of who he is, right? So why does God tell us not to commit adultery?
God is faithful.
Yeah, because God is faithful. For Muslim, no, God just doesn't want us to commit adultery. Don't know why. But for a Christian, the law is part of who he is. So when we say God is independent and free, we don't mean that he makes arbitrary decisions. He's his character does govern his will to act in accordance with his character. Alright. Aseity. Immutability is the next one. We'll do it with this one, but I should have shown you some passages to back that up. What does immutability mean? Anyone?
Doesn't change.
Unchanging, exactly. Exactly, unchanging. Can anyone think of a passage in the Bible where we might get this idea?
Isaiah 55.
You can look in James. Look in James, if you have your Bible. Yeah, that's right. That's from, where's that from? Oh, I hate it when I have. That's a famous passage, too. I should have that off the top of my head.
James, you said?
Yep. Go to the James's letter. I think it's in chapter 1. Just want to make sure, though.
Verse 17.
What does it say?
Every good and perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of the heavenly light, who does not change like shifting shadows.
Right. There you go. That's just one example. We also have it in Malachi. We have it throughout the Psalms and throughout the reads. God doesn't change. What if God changed?
We wouldn't know what He wants.
Huh?
We wouldn't know.
He would know what he was, maybe.
Subject, that would mean he would be subject to a force stronger than himself.
Ah, why? Because what has changed?
It's a force in itself.
You're going from one state of being to the next, and you don't change unless something's acted on you, or you're being drawn in some direction, right? And that would imply that God doesn't have, or that God needs to move into something he doesn't have already. Right?
That's right.
God's growing and becoming something better than he is, and that's not, or worse. Hmm? Because we always assume change is good, right?
Can God create a rock that he cannot lift?
Interesting. We will actually come to that question. The rock question will come up, but not right now. But that's a good question. Now, is change a good thing for us?
Sure.
Why? Sometimes. I mean, not always. I mean, we could, I could change from being a Christian to being an apostate, right? And that wouldn't be a good change. I could change from, that would be a good change, right? Right. So we can measure those things in goodness or badness according to what? To a goal that we're headed toward, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right. Now, if there can't be a goal that's better than God or beyond God, then change for God, I think, would necessarily be a downshift, right? I mean, he'd be going. He couldn't get better because he's already the superlative of everything that it is. And if he were to change, he would necessarily have to change to become less than perfect. So I would say that there'd be no way that God could change without ceasing to be God. We wouldn't have.
You have to take away the superlative then. We change because we have room for growth. We have room to be better.
Right.
God. But I preface my question. Excuse me.
Yeah.
I preface my question by saying it'd be the devil's advocate. Raise that.
Yeah.
Just to be a prick.
Well, this goes back to the question you asked a minute ago about what about the guy that you reason with and you make some points to and he just doesn't agree with you. Well, you're going to come to that point with pretty much everyone you talk to.
Mm-hmm.
Or not everyone, but a lot of people you talk to. They're just, you can give a perfectly sound, reasonable argument or defense of the Christian faith, and there are some people who are just going to look at you and say, I don't believe you. I think God should change. Okay, well, I've given you all the reasons why change in the divine being is not a good thing. So it looks like we're at loggerheads here. We just have to agree to disagree at that point. Because you can't persuade someone who's not going to share your principle.
I've been approached by people who felt that way. Well, God should shift, God should change. I would say, you want God to change comes from within. If you change, then maybe you will see how really great God is, because he's always that way. You'll see the real, the true side of it that will show up.
Well, there is a sense in which people want God to be like us. I mean, we want a God to be shaped by our culture and by our decisions and by our actions, by our desires, and he's not, and so that is irritating. I don't like that God doesn't change all the time. Sometimes I wish God would change and agree with me on certain things, and he doesn't, and that's pretty annoying.
But it wouldn't be a very stable kind of faith in that case. I mean, you would have no idea what to trust in.
Right, that's what I was saying.
That's
how Muslims feel.
Right, God can change his mind. You can do all the things Islam says to do, and you can die a righteous person, and God can say, well, you're in hell.
Yeah, there's a lot of people
right,
say God changes his mind.
And he'd be perfectly righteous to do that, or he'd be perfectly free to do that. We as Christians have our faith based on certain promises that Christ made, right? And if God can change, then we have no basis for believing those promises. We don't know. He might decide not to keep his end of the bargain. But because we know by reason and by scripture that God is unchanging, we can trust in the things that he says, and they'll always be true. And we can rely on them. All right, we are out of time. How's it going? You guys look sleepy. I'm tired. I'm sorry if I bored you to death. But
it's important.
Huh?